This meeting of the House Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. It is 3:15 p.m. Tuesday, February 3rd, 2026 in Davis 106. Members present are Representatives Schwanke, Ruffridge, Prox, and myself, Representative Mina Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Staffing the committee today, we have Andrew Giannotti as Health and Social Services Recording Secretary, Chloe Miller, our LAO moderator, and Katie Giorgio, my committee aide. If you need anything during the meeting, please don't hesitate to get her attention. The recently released legislative audit of the Office of Children's Services provides a critical look at the systems intended to protect children in our state. We acknowledge the incredibly difficult and complex work performed by OCS staff every day, and we thank you all at the division and also at the state for all of the work that you do. This committee's priority is clear, ensuring that when the state intervenes in the life of a child, it does so with the highest standard of care, urgency, and oversight. And we really appreciate all the work that's being done to help care for many of our vulnerable children in this state. Just a few housekeeping items, and I'll repeat this if we have other members come in during the meeting. We will start off with a presentation from the Department of Family and Community Services. There are many slides and information, so I will ask members to hold questions for specifics pauses as we go along the presentation. We will save the last 15 minutes of our committee time today to hear a brief introduction of Senate Bill 83 by Senator Klayman related to telehealth services. I would like to invite Department of Family and Community Services Acting Commissioner Tracy Dompling and OCS Director Kim Gui to the presenters' table. And in addition to our presenters, we have several other people available for questions. OCS Deputy Director Kim Swisher and Social Services Program Director Brooke Katasi. From the Legislative Audit Division, we have Chris Curtis in the room and Christine Lumba available on the phone. Please put yourselves on the record and begin your presentation.
Hi, good afternoon, committee members. For the record, my name is Tracy Dompling, and I'm the Acting Commissioner for the Department of Family and Community Services. While I've been in this Acting Commissioner role for about 5 weeks now, I did want to point out that in this department, either between the standalone department or as part of the Department of Health and Social Services, I have about 27 years worth of experience. I also worked for 2 years at the Department of Health as the director for the Division of Behavioral Health. I came back to this department last year in August as the deputy commissioner, and now I'm acting commissioner role. So I'm joined today by Director, Office of Children's Services Director Kim Gui. We want to thank you for the opportunity to present on House Bill 151, an overview, implementation, workforce challenges, and solutions. And I am going to turn it over to Director Gui.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Kim Gui. I'm the Director of Office of Children's Services. I've been with OCS for approximately 26 years, and I've been in this role for 5 years. I'm going to start off talking about a high-level overview of House Bill 151, which is titled Children Deserve a Loving Home Act. We often refer to it as HB 151. First, I want to express my gratitude. This bill passed in 2018. This legislation supported resource families, children, Office of Children's Services. It had a wide breadth of items underneath it that really were intended to reduce casework, improve the training, and increase stability for children. I'm going to dive a little bit more into the specifics, next slide, of HB 151.
And as we transition to this slide, I want to recognize that Representatives Fields, Gray, and Colomb all joined us at 3:19 p.m.
So on this slide, you will see various requirements that were passed under HB 151. Those green check marks on there are ones that we have implemented throughout OCS over the last 6 years of this bill. Some folks have described this law as the gold standard in child welfare. However, this law has not fixed the ills of child welfare in the state of Alaska. As a matter of fact, there is no state that is passing the federal reviews, and there is no law that has been created that's going to fix the complexities of child welfare. With that said, there are a lot of opportunities for growth, and we're going to get into that a little bit later. On this slide, I'm going to point out, highlight a few, and then I'm going to punt a few of the topics to a little bit later into the presentation. The ones I'm going to address a little bit later are caseworker training, the mentor program, and caseload averages. With that said, some of the items that we have implemented on here, foster care licensing, for example, we have decreased the amount of time it takes to be licensed. It currently takes 43 days when an applicant has turned in their application to licensure. The licensing packet back in the day, 2018, 2019, was 33 pages, is currently 13 pages. We also assign individuals within OCS to work with possible foster parents if they have background barriers that need variances. So we work with that person to help navigate the system because it can be complex. Family connections under here. Family connections, what we did is we updated our policy and our training to strengthen understanding and the importance of sibling contact and family connections. In 2025, our quality assurance team assessed that cases reviewed were rated as a strength across all areas of Alaska. As a matter of fact, 88% of the cases reviewed made concerted efforts to ensure visitation between children, parents, and siblings was sufficient frequency and the quality to promote child relationships. As far as relative placements, the quality assurance team at last year, 2025, indicated that 98% of the cases reviewed made concerted efforts to place children with relatives, and our data reports from part two of the legislative audit shows less than 2% of children at a home placement do not have relatives documented in ORCA. So what that tells me is 98% of our cases have relatives documented in ORCA. In addition to that, we are partnering closely with co-signers, which are our tribes that are part of the Alaska Tribal Child Welfare Compact. They also help with the relative search. One of the continued challenges of HB 151 is the technical aspect note of supervisors certifying relatives have been entered. And you'll see this on the bottom of the slide titled Supervisor Relative Search Certification. This is one area that we have failed to implement successfully and is a continued challenge. Although that, with that said, the intent behind HB 151 was to make sure relatives were entered, and relatives are entered, and that is what it says. We just don't have a supervisor that's going in and documenting that within the ORCA system. I'm going to talk about a little bit why that's not happening a little further down. Another topic under here is transition-aged youth. And what this means is involving children, youth, 14 and older, in their own case plans and their permanency plans. It's making sure that we are helping youth collect and gather the documents needed when they exit foster care or when they need them for a driver's license or a job. We are doing that fairly successfully. We are having some hiccups with our Social Security Administration, with the federal government on some of the delays there. The next one, foster parent decision making. This is a federal law, and then HB 151 came after that federal law. What this means is it includes foster parents in the day-to-day decision-making of children in their own, the foster children in their home. It encourages children and youth to participate in normal activities and should use the prudent parenting standard and considering the child's age, developmental level, and particular abilities. Back in the day, for an example, when I was a caseworker, we didn't want foster children jumping on trampolines, or they couldn't travel outside of Anchorage to go Kenai to go fishing without getting permissions and notes. That is no longer the case. Reporting requirements, one of the check boxes here. Since the passing of this bill, we are continuously reporting as appropriately to the legislative auditors. We have mentioned, as I will mention, we're going to talk about some of our data and our methodologies, but we take the feedback, recognize when we make mistakes, and we are nothing but transparent. We are not a perfect system. We are a broken system. But I'm going to talk about some solutions and some ideas moving forward. So the two bullets at the bottom we're going to address throughout the slides. And I'm going to pause real quick and see if there are questions before I move to the next slide.
Do we have any questions from the committee? Representative Prox?
Yes. Thank you. Through the chair, actually, maybe the first one, I'll wait until we're done. Relative placement. How's that going?
Through the chair, Representative Prox. We're on par where we have been. I think we dropped 1%. I think we're 49% of our children placed are with relatives at this time. We would like to see that higher, especially with our disproportionate number of Alaska Native children in care. Mm-hmm. So I think that is a goal of ours, is to increase relative placement. And so that's kind of where we're sitting at this moment.
Okay. And will you be getting into things you've thought about to improve it?
Through the chair. Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Thanks for being here. So through the chair, you were just talking about always being transparent. And on page 9 of the audit and report conclusions, it says high vacancies and turnover led to excess budget authority, which was used in part for other purposes. And so I think a lot of people have had questions what the other purposes were.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, I believe you're talking about recommendation number 7 on the legislative audit, part 3. Is that correct?
So my staff printed off the entire audit, and I'm on page 9 of whatever is printed off for me. So the title at the top of the page is Report Conclusions.
Is it $10 million that they're discussing in there?
They're doing the $20.7 million of additional funding and authorizing 110 new frontline caseworker positions for high vacancies. So the $20.7 million that was for authorizing the 110 caseworker positions, but then there was a lot of vacancies, so that money wasn't used. And so it says that the money was therefore used for other purposes.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, without specifics, what I can tell you is the money is used to run child welfare. And so when we don't have positions, as we got within Health Bill 151, what that usually means, we're spending a lot of that money in overtime for our staff. Or we're looking at trying to do contracts or hire long-term non-perms or on-call staffing. So that is typically where we try to get creative on how to serve our families and our youth with the budget that we're allocated. Did that answer your question, or do you have a...
Thank you. Follow-up?
Oh, follow-up?
I wish that it said that. I wish that it said high vacancies and turnover led to the money being used for overtime. You know, something like that, because I think the use of, you know, other purposes, it makes you wonder where the money was.
And if I may add, so if you continue on reading in the audit, it talks about some of those funds and how they've been used related to paying a fine from the 2021 cyber attack. That's on page 12 of the audit, where there was $2 million of those funds. We do have Chris Curtis here. I wonder if you could come to the presenter's table and also answer Representative Gray's question.
Certainly, for the record, I'm Chris Curtis. I'm your state legislative auditor. So the paragraphs you're reading from are summary paragraphs. And so if you go into the audit, like you mentioned on page 11 and 12, we explain what those other purposes are. As mentioned by Director Gray, overtime is part of the solution. Also, the division has a lot of flexibility to use to transfer funds or authority between allocations. And so they have like 6 or 7 allocations within the appropriations. So they move that around for like foster care payment rates. That's an often one I see. Also, the legislature during the budget process has moved some of the authority in a very transparent way that were was originally appropriated for this purpose for other purposes. In addition, the cyber attack, also funding the tribal compact. This has been a pot of money. $11 million of it has been used over the years to fund the tribal compact. So all the details are listed on pages like 9 through 12.
Follow up? Thank you. So there's lots of things that can be done with that money. But could it be to increase the pay of caseworkers?
Through the chair, no. It cannot under my my authority, right? We would have to, we're all unionized. We have to go through a classification study. Now, if I got something back that said I could increase their salary schedule or I could change their job description to something else where they had higher steps, then we could use that money to do that. But I don't I do not have the authority as the director to change the salary for my staff.
I saw Rep. Fields and then Rep. Schwanke after.
Through the chair, I mean, that's technically true, but you can just do a letter of agreement with the union, right? I mean, it's not, yeah, you can't change the salary technically, but you can change the amount of money that employees get.
Through the chair, we can do letters of agreement, and we have had letters of agreement in this last 6 years. During this, we had letters of agreements, for example, for retaining retention bonuses for our frontline caseworking staff. So we have tried different methods of retention, and that was one of them. I will say that the job classes, the staff are called Protective Services Specialists 1, 2, 3. We are not the only division that has PSS 1, 2, 3s, and we have run into union issues when we try to do something specific with some of the class that they're representing, right? So, for example, even supervisors, if we wanted to give them retention bonuses, the idea is, well, one for all and all for one. So we occasionally run into pushback from unions or higher-ups as far as getting the LOAs approved or authorized.
Okay.
Representative Schwanke?
Thank you, through the chair. I'll add on to Representative Fields' question. Can you describe the bonus program a little bit more? What size bonuses type of thing, and did you have to have an LOA to give bonuses?
Through the chair, Representative Schwanke, thank you for the question. First, yes, we had to have LOAs to give bonuses, and I had to get an LOA from the GGU, and I had to get an LOA for the supervisors' unions because the bonuses were for staff that had been here, so their retention bonuses, and it was 10% of their annual salary split over 2 years. So the first year, if you were here for a year or longer, you got 6%. The following year, you would get 4%. And then when it concluded. They were done. And so there are no more retention bonuses. That was something that we are doing right close to the pandemic or right after the pandemic.
Quick follow-up?
Follow-up.
And so did the union push back on those LOAs? Are they, like, holding on? Do they have to sign off on an LOA that you do with an individual employee?
Through the chair, yes. They have to sign off on any LOAs that we push through or get approved. And so there is a process through the state that we submit it up to the department. The department sends it up to, I believe, Department of Law. Department of Law then goes to the governor's office. OMB, we also have to have the funding to do that. So there are layers, and then it also goes to the union as well.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, back to the cyber fine, the $10 million. So it's my understanding that the $10 million was put aside to pay the fine, but then we never got contacted to pay the fine. So where is the $10
million? Through the chair, my background is not necessarily in finance. What I understand is we did not have to pay the fine, but I believe that the monies were I have a statement I can read. Let me read the statement so I don't misrepresent what I do know. So it says, during the reappropriation period, the Department of Health and Social Services Commissioner exercised their transfer authority to reallocate excess funds from multiple divisions to the Department of Social Services. The transfer was executed for two specific purposes: addressing a probable fine resulting from an unavoidable cyber attack and covering the costs associated with the Office of Inspector General audit. This reallocation did not impair the department's ability to deliver services and was conducted under the guidance of the agency's audit coordinator based on their findings of a GASB requirement for costs to be recognized in the year the obligation is identified and measured. The cyber attack encumbrance has been liquidated. That's what I've got on that one.
Sorry, quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you. Through the chair, so you just said the unavoidable cyber attack. We were fined for an unavoidable cyber – well, we were going to be fined for an unavoidable cyber attack. So we put – they took the $10 million out, and it can't be put back in, and we didn't get fined for the unavoidable cyber attack. I just want to make sure that I understood the statement.
Through the chair, I believe that is correct. The acting commissioner Dompling may have more to add on that.
Or through the chair, can the auditor?
Certainly. One thing that department has and has been granted over the years, authority to transfer money, revenues, or unexpended revenues through cross appropriations. And we've advised the finance committees that this can create issues, and this is one of them, to where authority, unused authority, could be transferred over to for some other purpose. So to pay, say, a fine, maybe the legislature would never know if the fine happened because the money was transferred over. And so our issue with this was that there was never a fine, and it was just based on an expectation that there could be, that the authority was transferred instead of lapsing. And so the money, when it doesn't lapse, it doesn't become available for other uses.
Thank you.
And at one point of follow-up, the finding really is directed to Department of Health, to where the authority was transferred before the split, then Department of Health had that. So the recommendation is directed to Department of Health.
Thank you. Oh, Representative Prox?
I hate to get into the details because of time, but fined for something that was unavoidable. A rock rolled down the hill and fell on my car. That was unavoidable. Why would I get fined for something that is unavoidable?
That's questions to me, Chair. I believe the act is a possible violation of HIPAA.
Correct.
Right. But the only reason...
Follow-up
through the chair. The only reason I would think somebody would get fined is because it was avoidable, as opposed to an unavoidable fine. That is an oxymoron, I guess.
Through the chair, Representative Prox, I believe it's hard to protect cyber attacks anywhere these days, and I think that we have a responsibility as a state agency to protect information, and when that information was hacked, then that, I'm not a lawyer, but I believe that would then fall upon us for due diligence and making sure that that shouldn't have happened, or if it did, what we're going to do to remedy that.
Yeah, okay. Never mind. Well, we can't spend time. That's okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. I have one quick question, and then we can move on to the next slide. Just related to the reporting requirements, so page 20 of the audit talked about how the five-year recruitment and retention plan, it doesn't update every 5 years. Looking prospectively, it looks at the 2019 plan and then just gives updates on annual updates on it. So I'm just wondering just your response to that feedback for the recruitment and retention plan.
Chair Mina, on the recruitment and retention plan, we have had and we continue to have a forward-looking recruitment and retention plan. Our understanding of the law was that we had to have a five-year plan. It didn't say if I update 2026, I should be planning 2031, right? So we always have a forward-looking plan. And so that was some misunderstanding of what the law was stating compared to what we were doing. I will say one of our number one priorities at OCS is our recruitment and retention, and we do have a plan, and we will continue to have a plan, a robust plan, that I'll talk more about in this presentation.
Okay. Thank you. We'll move on to the next slide.
Okay, I was about page 20, but...
Okay. We'll move on to the next slide.
All right.
Should I move back?
Okay. That sounds good. Thank you.
All right. So as we are looking at HB 151, I would be remiss if I did not discuss the pandemics and the impacts it had in the child welfare system as a whole. The pandemic changed our landscape. It is not an excuse. It is our reality. OCS experienced recruitment retention issues that were exacerbated, and many of those issues well before HB 151. OCS, State of Alaska, is not alone in our struggles of recruitment and retention of child welfare staff. One thing about OCS, and I think you all know this, but I just want to state it because it's important. We don't close our doors. We don't turn off our phone. If I have one person, we continue to do our job as best as we can. We don't have a capacity and then we stop building our widgets, right? We continue to do the best we can do with the staff that we have. And so what that means is it's often, people are often overwhelmed. They are often have too much to do the job that they came to OCS to do, which was to really work diligently with children and families. But I am proud that we don't just turn off our phone because we've reached our caseload cap, which we don't have. We don't have a caseload cap. We have to continue serving. And this isn't just OCS. This is also our entire department. One of the reasons that we are split into a different department from Department of Health is because we have to show up on those snow days where everyone gets to work from home. We don't work from home. We show up, we knock on doors, and we do what has to be done for children and families. OCS was identified by the Department of Personnel as a division that needed to pilot competency-based hiring in 2019. This was to address the lack of applicants that we were seeing to fill the many PCNs that came with HB 151. There was such an onslaught of PCNs, we could not find the people to take the jobs. So we started this new pilot of competency-based hiring. And as you know, competency-based hiring became a statewide initiative through the governor, I believe, in 2021. So competence-based hiring opened the door for more applicants with a variety of experience. As a result, our applicants look different. They are coming with less education, less social services experience. I myself have a master's degree in social work, and I recognize the importance education brings to our field. But I will also say we have some wonderful staff that have experience and do great casework. And they show up every day, and they meet families where they're at, and they have all sorts of experience that they are bringing in. It also allows us to bring in the lived experience folks. It allows us to bring people in from rural Alaska that often, that sometimes don't have had the educational requirements that were needed before we moved to competency-based hiring. What we've had to do with the new staff and who are coming to our door is we've had to pivot and change how we train them, how we supervise them. There is a whole lot of nuances that had to pivot very quickly during COVID when we started seeing new staff, remote learning, and those nature and things of that nature. Also during COVID, during the pandemic, we had to pivot to online training. However, in 2023, we went to a blended model, which is both in-person, virtual classrooms, and online. This is now a practice across the country. Fun fact, hundreds of colleges for social work programs deliver full online bachelor degrees. During the past several years, we have struggled to get our campus-based training to align with our vision of field-based training and practical applications of child welfare. But this past year, we've had some success in shifting our training to include more field-based transfer of learning opportunities where classroom knowledge is applied, and we begin to build worker capacity to do the work. We will never stop evaluating and improving our training. We will always be working to improve as the social situations of our parents and youth, their landscape changes, as does ours. We pride ourselves in really being an agency of continual quality improvement and looking to make edits and changes as we go. Another one on this list of impacts, and I don't want to go in too much because you all know this, foster families. Many of our foster families closed the door during the pandemic. And we have been working exceptionally hard to get those numbers back up. Some of the things that we have done is we have centralized, let me back up. We started with foster care forums. We are holding virtual foster care forums. What can we do? What do you need from us? We heard them, and they wanted a centralized call line. We stood up our special needs call line. They wanted us to be available till later into the evening. We shifted our hours to 8 o'clock at night for them. They wanted respite. They're burned out, right? I understand it. We set up a respite program. So we are trying to hear where people are at and then make those changes. In 2024, we increased the foster care base rate by 30%. So there is a lot that we're doing, and we're trying to make things better. We're trying to get more folks to the table. Just a quick little data. Let's see. Oh, let me tell you. In 2025, we had 84 recruitment events across all five regions. Those recruitment events, we're working with tribes, churches, medical communities, and organizations throughout the state. Just this morning, there were numerous OCS and tribes in the Tribal State Collaboration Group. We just celebrated our 32nd year together. And we spent a good portion of this morning's 4 hours talking about resource family crisis. We broke into groups. We talked about barriers and ideas. We had community cafes. So this is an area that we are concerned about and we're continuing to work on. Lastly on this slide, community resources during the pandemic were extremely difficult. A lot of places closed their doors, limited their hours, moved to virtual themselves. We lost a lot of community providers. Some are coming back online, obviously. But some of the things during the pandemic that we didn't anticipate was the struggles and the special needs that our youth and children would have and the costs that were associated with those. So I will pause here for questions.
Thank you. Representative Fields.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm still puzzled at this assertion that unions get in the way of pay raises. I've never actually heard that before. And maybe, Ms. Quay, you could write us an email explaining all the different ways that you can implement bonuses, pay raises through LOAs, every possible tool in the midst of a collective bargaining agreement. And maybe the committee could also ask for the same information from ASEA and APEA, just to make sure we're all on the same page.
Sounds good, Justin.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Mina. Through the chair, we have been in this committee now for over 30 minutes. And before I say what I'm going to say, I'm going to say some of the dearest friends I have in the whole world work in this very important area, and I appreciate very dearly the work that's being done here. I'm frustrated that we have not gone over, I don't think, anything in here that is relevant to discussing the very serious document that I have in front of me. I appreciate Representative Fields' question. I think that's very appropriate. But some of these recommendations are really serious. I've read a lot of audits. We have words like woefully insufficient, exceedingly poor. This is talking about our hiring process, very simply, and our training process. We just went over some of these things in implemented HB 151 requirements. I've obviously read this slide deck. I don't see how we're going to go into things that I think is what the public wants to hear and what I want to hear. So I may be giving, I know you probably can't go away from your notes, but I'm going to encourage you to do so, because I want to hear how this report has changed how you are doing work inside of your department. What you need from us, because under my expectation here, I think the legislature has given you and the department every single tool available to make this process be better. This report came out 3 months ago, so I know that everything that you've been doing for 2 years is probably in this report. So my question is, if we were going to redo this audit in November of this year, would it read differently? I think I know the answer to that question, and the answer to that is no. We know you have workforce shortages. We've heard about it. This is my fourth year hearing about it. To Representative Fields' point, I run a business. If I have a workforce shortage, there's literally a slew of things I do to fix that. I pay people differently. I make their working environment better. I make their training better. The consultant recommend that OCS conduct a re-engineering of their business processes. Impacts from pandemic and your recruitment and retention framework is not a re-engineering. We have a little bit of time left in this presentation. I really hope that we're gonna actually address this thing, this audit in front of us. I haven't heard it yet. This slide wasn't it. The slide before it wasn't it. I don't know. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I know there's not a question in there, but I really hope we get to it. It's really important to me. I'd like to think outside the box, because we would like to give you the tools that are necessary to fix this, because it actually is both people that have good hearts that want to do this work well, and we know that, you know that, and it's about kids. I worked through here. I don't see kids. I'd say this every year. I don't see kids in this report. But what the report from, from the slide deck, what the report from our auditor says is that kids are in foster care for 3 years on average. That's what the report says, before they have permanency of any type. That's actually against the law. Not having caps is against the law. It's not a law I passed. It was passed before me. But our division right now is not following the law that was set. And to me, this is a serious hearing. And I want to hear serious answers. And that's it.
I have another question.
I'll go to Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I heard you talk about a 30% increase to the stipend for foster families. And that's interesting to me. I was a foster parent. I didn't care about the stipend. I don't want to speak for my colleague. But I just, from my perspective, you did what you had to do to try to get more foster parents. But then I heard you talk earlier about with caseworkers, we never turn anyone away. So no matter how few employees we have, they're just going to have to take care of more people. And, I mean, not to beat a dead horse, the unions are standing in the way of us offering any more money to our employees. And I just think when I watch the hearings for House Bill 151, I watch the Senate floor session, I watch the debate, they really believed that they were going to massively improve the system because they were going to increase the number of caseworkers, and caseworkers would have manageable workloads. They would have a better quality of life. They would have better hours, and they would be able to focus on the cases in front of them. And I think the mistake that was made in 2018 was that in order to fill those vacancies, they needed to pay a lot more money so that folks would apply for those jobs. And that's what we haven't done. And I think, I'm sorry, I think it was a mistake to say, well, the only thing we can do is just take away all standards and we'll hire anybody to do this job. And Amanda Mativier has said it on the record that when she was the trainer, that people showed up who thought they were going to be security guards, who thought they were applying for childcare positions. They were showing up to do a job that was to go into people's homes and decide if that child should be removed from his family forever. And they didn't know how to do it, and they didn't know what they were signing up for. So to me, the thing that we need to be talking about is how we never implemented House Bill 151. We never implemented it. We need to talk about how to implement the law that we have in front of us. And I actually had a question. you mentioned a moment ago about how social worker programs are now online, and you mentioned that by going online, you're able to train workers in rural Alaska. I'm curious about whether we've increased the number of rural employees working for OCS thanks to this online, this more online system.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, thank you for what you were saying there. I wanted to correct one thing. It's not just unions that are blocking raises, right? The state of Alaska is an entire system. I do think in 2018 they missed thinking about how are we going to get experienced people to the table. But here's what I know is everywhere in the country is struggling to find people to do child welfare. It is very difficult, heart-wrenching, trauma-induced work. That's a reality. We don't have the UAA system does not produce enough social workers for our state. If we paid people more, maybe we would get different people to the table. But at the time when we switched to competency base, I'm thankful for that because we were not getting anyone during COVID, right? People were not wanting to go knock on doors and sit in the cars with kids that had COVID. We had to do that. So some people to do the job is better than no people to do the job. I would love to see a bunch of very experienced child welfare workers or people who have social services experience doing this work. That's not the reality that we live in. And again, I, from all my understanding, do not have the authority to change the salary for my staff. I bring up all sorts of questions and push the box all the time trying to change child welfare. I am not a stagnant leader. I am not someone who sits here for 26 years and does not take my job seriously, as does everyone else at OCS, because this is what we get when we come out and talk about the problems of child welfare, is finger pointing that we're not doing our job correctly. And you know what? It needs to be done better. And we need help. That is why I try to be transparent. It's why I try to say, like, let's work on this together. And I want to do better. We want to do better, right? We need, our families need us to do better. Our tribes need us to do better. So as far as your question goes, I'm going to backtrack on that one. No, we are still struggling in rural Alaska to get people to the table to hire. I will say when we talk to our staff about moving to more in-person, our workforce is predominantly female. They do not want to be away from their home for 6 weeks for $26 an hour. They don't want to. They do not want to leave their families and their communities for 6 weeks a year to be trained to do this job. So what we have done is we have created a model that folds in online training, synchronous and asynchronous, transfer of learning, Zoom calls, and in-person, and then our mentors go into the field with our staff. So we are trying to blend the best we can with what we have. So I hope that answers your question.
One more follow-up, and then we'll go to the next slides.
Okay, so really fast, speaking of the work, the caseworker workloads, it seems that what's being reported in the audit, and this might be a question for the auditor, is the caseloads are being spread out among supervisors and specialist positions that are not carrying cases. And so to me, that is making the caseload problem look not as dire as it actually is. And I couple that with, on page 20, with the OCS reported of 81 vacancies, but then the auditor finds 93 vacancies. And I'm just curious why there's a discrepancy in the number of vacancies being reported.
That's a great question, through the chair, Representative Gray. So we have 608 PCNs, and it's sometimes difficult, and right now I have 99 vacancies. So there are times where it is hard to figure out where our vacancies, where our positions are, right? I have, I was out without an admin manager for 7 months. I couldn't fill the position, right? That was their job to kind of help manage some of the stuff. It's not an excuse that that's our reality. What ends up happening is I'm going to move a PCN that I haven't filled out of Craig, Alaska, and I'm going to move it to central office, and they're going to do a specialized job. That takes us a while. Things get lost in the process, right? So I think that was, there was some discrepancy in the data that we have resolved because we have smart sheets where we're monitoring all this stuff now, so it's not on someone's Excel that has left the shop. So that is definitely helping navigate some of these lost PCNs. I do want to address, because sometimes there's a misnomer that we're hiding cases, and we are not hiding cases by any sense of the means. The problem is I have an antiquated 25-year-old system that doesn't accurately count cases. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about what that looks like, because it's complex, which makes it really difficult for us to report and the auditors to really line up on the same page. So, for example, if I'm a family that's in Anchorage and gives birth to a child, but I live in rural Alaska, Anchorage may take that case as a primary because maybe the abuse occurred in Anchorage. Well, the baby stays in Anchorage because it needs medical treatment. The family is back in rural Alaska. I assign a worker in Anchorage who's the primary worker, and I have to assign a secondary worker in rural Alaska to work with the parents in their location. So who has more work to do? It depends on the case, right? Some cases I have 8 kids. Some cases I have 6 parents. Some cases I have 1 mom, 1 kid. So no one case is the same. Right. If I had my wishes, we would have a system that weighted cases, right? Because that way you would be able to assign, you would really know what a case is. So a caseworker may have 15 cases, but 5 of their cases are out of the region and they don't even see those families, right? They're working with the secondary worker on those cases. Supervisors, there's a slide on here where it talks about healthy turnover. You'll see that we are promoting a lot of our staff into different positions. Sometimes it's best for families to stick with the worker that they had as they move into supervisors. And so maybe they're close to permanency. Maybe they're close to a reunification or close to an adoption. We're not going to transfer that case to a new worker because it delays permanency. It has all sorts of research-based effects that does not look good. So they will keep that case, sometimes on purpose, and sometimes because I just don't have the staff to assign. And we do try to do gradual assignments when workers first start. So in the first 6 months, we are trying to guard them as much as possible to make sure they have time to learn and grow and move into knowledge of working cases. So our supervisors and our managers sometimes carry those cases. It's not hidden. It's just not tracked on here because there's no way to track it in our ORCA system. And that's the reality. And I will tell you, for us to track this data is a huge administrative burden. It's important, and we're going to do it, but it takes hours upon hours to go through this and do this data. That's just a reality. Next slide.
Rupshanki has a question, and then I'll hold questions for a few slides until we get to the end of the case load slides.
Yep.
Representative Sharkey.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm going to kind of go back just a little bit, kind of an overarching question here. So I would like to know from you a little bit more about how the tribal compact works and how you work with that process. I'm a little confused. I saw in the governor's budget $5 million for tribal compacting for child welfare, and then I see in the audit $11 million was spent on tribal compacting. So I'm very curious about the discrepancy there. The hiring, is that done by tribes? Do you include those numbers throughout the audit? There are numbers on overtime. There's numbers on caseloads. There's numbers on cases that went up or down, especially there's a table in particular that references 2015 to 2023 numbers. So the tribal compacting came in the middle. I'm kind of curious, is it all lumped together in this? Do you have oversight over all of that? Just kind of help me understand that a little bit better would be really helpful.
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Swanky, the Alaska Child Welfare Compact actually came into fruition about the same time HB 151 did. We call the tribes co-signers. So it's a government-to-government agreement that we have with 18 co-signers, which equates to around 170 of the 229 tribes. This government-to-government agreement has all sorts of documents to help us navigate child welfare. And so we started off really building the infrastructure back in 2018-19, ironing out confidentiality issues, things of that nature. And then we started working in what we call scopes of work. And so one of the first things that we did with the Tribal Compact is they took on what we call initial and ongoing relative search. So when children come into care, we have 30 days to do a relative search on that family. So we were giving that information to the tribes, and the tribes were going in. They're contacting families, finding relatives, entering them to our ORCA system, and then they are sending out notices to request placement. So we do that in the first 30 days, and then we do it through the life of the case, specifically if children are not placed with a relative. So as I mentioned, 170 tribes, 18 co-signers, are doing initial and ongoing relative searches. Over the years, we have expanded the dollar amount into the compact. So currently we're at $5 million annually, GF. We started off under a million. I can't remember how much it was. And
0.6.
Yeah, and then we've gone up and gone up. And so there are five different scopes of work besides the initial and ongoing relative search. They also do family contact. They also do licensing assists. So they'll go out and license homes. And it could be Alaska Native homes, or it could also be a non-Alaska Native in one of their locations. So whether it's like a family living in Nome, for example, they may not be tribal, but they're a family that's willing to do be licensed foster parents, so they'll go license them. They also, the fifth scope of work that they do is called a safety walkthrough. So if we have a grandma who lives in rural Alaska and they have boots on the ground, they will go out to the grandma's house and do a walkthrough to see if the home is safe. Who's in the home? Do they have exits? Do they have fire extinguishers, fire alarms? They go do all of that, and then they give us the information back. So it saves us having to fly out there and do all that travel time. So those are the five scopes of work they do. And in addition to that, they also do primary and secondary prevention. And so secondary prevention is working. They get all of our screen out protective services reports. So if someone calls the agency and says, I've got a, you know, this child has showed up at school for 8 days in the same clothes. We'll give them that information. That's not something that we're probably going to go investigate, but the tribes can call them and say, hey, can we show up? Can we come talk to you? What's going on, right? So they do high-risk work, secondary work, tertiary work, to try to prevent Alaska Native families from coming into care.
Quick follow-up.
Okay, so they obviously fill a tremendous number of gaps in rural Alaska, and I'm extremely grateful for that. My curiosity still comes back to budget and spend, and if they are operating somewhat independently on some of this activity, how is the state of Alaska able to kind of control the scope of the additional spend, and if it's, does it come back in the supplemental when it's over the appropriated amount?
Through the chair, Representative Swonky, it does not ever go over the amount. So I think it's the last 3 years it's been $5 million every year. Sometimes it goes under, but it never goes over.
Where does the $11 million come in?
I think that was year after year.
Okay, cumulative.
Thank you. That's the word I'm looking for.
Thank you. Next slide.
All right. So this slide just highlights some data points. It is a six-year look at our turnover data on the left slide there. And then on the right side is our by region of turnover data. And again, it does highlight what we call healthy turnover. So for example, Anchorage had a 42% turnover rate in November of 24 to October 31st, 25. But if you take out promotions and folks that have demoted but they're still with the agency, it's actually 27.3%. So every region is seeing has some healthy turnover, with the exception of Western region. Next slide. So this just shows a little bit about the caseloads and our struggle to meet HB 151 caseload averages. It shows a six-year look about where the averages are. These are a little deceptive, right? Because what Representative Gray said about our cases that are being held by supervisors or specialty positions, it's an average. So I could have a brand new worker in here that started last week and has two cases, and I could have a worker in Anchorage that has 29 cases right now. So it's an average. When I show this to staff, they don't like this slide because it doesn't show their reality either. But right now, it's as good as we can get with our aging data system. Obviously, one of the issues that we've had specifically in Anchorage and Western Region has been a region, I'm going to say 15 years at this point, and we have struggled notoriously on Western Region on keeping that office staffed for years. Anchorage is a new one. We have never had issues with keeping Anchorage staffed. We're not getting the applicants. We're seeing high turnover. And some of the issues that we're having in Anchorage and Western specifically is our investigations, we call them investigations and assessment, is pulled into here. So we count that case once. But what ends up happening is the numbers get inflated because we're not closing the case down. So we're screening an investigation in. We're going out to see if the children are safe, doing our cursory look at what's going on, and we're moving to the next case. And so that case is staying open, and we're not closing it down because we don't have enough workers right now. So we are prioritizing the work that is getting done. So that's one of the reasons that we're seeing some elevation in Anchorage and Western. And frankly, the job market in Anchorage is harder for people to want to come work. There's more opportunity to do other things and than to work for OCS. Next slide.
I'll take a pause here to see if people have questions.
I have a quick question about the previous slide.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, it's just I know that you're working with an antiquated system that makes it difficult for you to pull out supervisors who are carrying cases, and it's an average. You have newer workers who might have two cases. But I think that there's probably a way to have the new worker slide and then to have the experienced worker slide and then to have the slide that shows how many cases the supervisors are carrying, and that it wouldn't, we're not dealing in the numbers of like 10,000 of people. We're dealing in the, we're hundreds of people. This could be done in a few hours. You could actually have slides that are more accurate about the caseloads, and that's what people are concerned about. And you said that your employees don't like the slide. You could probably make slides that your employees feel are more accurate.
Thank you. Through the chair, we do have a report that we have turned in every year, and it makes the slide look nice, the slide before. And this is what our data looks like. And it's very, you got to be pretty skilled in what it says. And we've been looking at this and thinking that it does need some editing and changing, because it does break it down by, if you're a new worker, if you've been here 1 to 3 months, 4 to 6 months, 7 plus months. So there is quite a bit of data on here. And so what I've shared here is high level overview. But I do have, and we can submit this to you if you'd like it. But we are talking about changing what this looks like. I would say the narrative, though, is the caseloads are too high, except for in Southeast and is it South Central right now. They do have manageable caseloads. And Northern has also had manageable caseloads in the last year or two. We really seem to be struggling the most in Anchorage and the Western region.
Quick follow-up. Thank you. I appreciate that you have the data in a hard-to-read format. I think that that could be converted into an easier-to-read graph.
Yes.
And I think using this general high-level graph that's not really giving an accurate picture of what the PCNs have, you know, what the actual caseload-carrying caseworkers have, would just be more honest.
Through the chair, yeah, I didn't know how detailed you all wanted. I mean, we will be back. So we can definitely get more information and highlight that for you. Mm-hmm. So at OCS, we have been working, as I mentioned, on workforce and recruitment retention issues for years. We adopted the U.S. Surgeon General's workforce framework approximately 4 years ago. And you'll see at the center of this is the worker voice. And so we really try to listen to what our staff are telling us. And there's a variety of ways to put our staff in the center of the circle. We have a staff advisory board. We have a supervisor leadership council. We have a management group. We have a change management group.
So we really try, and we just launched an anonymous online suggestion box for staff to submit ideas and solutions. So we really try to put them at the center of all this so we can hear their ideas, their solutions, the problems that are out there. So through all this, we have been doing quite a bit of work trying to improve the culture within OCS so people believe that they're at the right place because there is a lot of burnout that can happen doing the job, and so we need to make sure that we're caring for our employees as much as possible. Next slide. These next two slides are on recruitment and retention strategies. Many of these are redundant. You have all seen them before. I did want to highlight just a few of ways that we're trying to be innovative. We developed a mentor program before 151, but 151 allowed us to expand our mentor program. Our mentor program receives rave reviews from our supervisors, our caseworkers. It was studied through the UAA School of Social Work. They wrote research articles on it. It's a great process. We expanded. I think we currently have 7 mentors currently that travel around the state and help all new staff within the first six months of their job. They develop staff development plans and work on how to engage with children and families, looking at what data they need to understand to try to be good caseworkers. We also have launched reflective supervision 2 years ago. We have been investing in our supervisors' understanding and education on things that we do, things that are important. And so we initially launched it with our case-caring supervisors, and it's been so popular we have moved it to the entire state. The last bullet on here that I wanted to address, which I've kind of already talked about, was competency-based, value-based hiring. We worked with the University of Colorado. We also worked in conjunction with the state of Oklahoma. Other states across the country have gone to more competency-based, value-based hiring. And so we are trying to work to make the most that we can with the situation we have. So I won't go too much more into that because we have discussed that quite a bit. The next slide on recruitment and retention strategies. Some other things that we have done is the occupational endorsement for an interprofessional child welfare certificate. So we worked – sorry, that was a lot of words, and I'm talking fast because I want to be mindful of time. We worked with UAA to develop a child welfare certificate. And so what that means is people are coming to the agency that do not have the education or people that are in a bachelor's program, but they're not quite sure what they want to do after they graduate. You can get a certificate in child welfare. And so we have some of our staff that are faculty that train these classes. And to date, we have had 44 staff members that have gone and gotten their child welfare certificate. And we are paying for those costs. Of those 44, 20% have been promoted at this point and are staying with the agency. So that's great news. We also implemented paid internships 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And then we have some internships that they choose not to be paid, but they still want to work for us. And so that's a great avenue for us to bring people in with some education. And hopefully they stay on with OCS or they get a greater understanding of what we do. I'll talk a little bit more about the training. I've talked about the training of 6 weeks. We have, it is a blending. It is not just all online. There's some in person. There's some where they're in a classroom together virtually. We also go out into the field with them. So we really have, and we will continue to look at training. We're in the process of revamping it to launch a new launch out in July. We're looking at more simulations. More in person. We also do forensic interviewing training, which is a week long in person. So there's a multitude of trainings that we do to really carve out the skills necessary for the job. I'll pause real quick for questions.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Mina. Director Gui, you've read this audit, yeah?
Oh, yes.
It, It seems like the words that you're saying and the slides that you're presenting are not connected to this audit in any way. So is this audit wrong?
Through the chair, in what way is it wrong? I mean, like, which part?
Okay, so you said that the mentor program was essentially a glowing success. This audit says OCS's management structure found, or the review of OCS's management structure found the new training program focused on the clinical side of the work, but failed to incorporate practical aspects of the job. In addition, interviewees described training as taking place remotely, limited mostly to remote delivered mentoring and coaching by overburdened supervisors and overburdened coworkers. Voluntary supplementary training was not helpful and was difficult to take. We recommend OCS consider implementing a more comprehensive training program that is grounded in practical applications. Furthermore, this is strongly out of alignment with best practices and is not realistic and leaves people with little to no understanding of what their job actually entails.
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, thank you for the clarification. Yes, some of that is wrong. First off, when the audit was done, it was 2023, but they were at our door at 2024. So there was a delay, and it's not all wrong, but there is parts of there of what you read that is incorrect. They hired a contractor called PCG, and I can't tell you what it stands for right now, some kind of consulting group. They came in and they did small focus groups with 200 staff. There was no rhyme or reason how it was done. My staff came back to me and said, we don't even understand what just happened. Like, that was the most unfocused focus group. So we disagreed with some of the things that PCG recommended in there. With that said, not all of it was false. We did need to change our training, and we had already started changing our training. We knew it wasn't practical, and we were working with our contractor at the university at that time to try to get to be more practical. To be honest with you, got a lot of pushback because we wanted our trainers in the field with our staff, and they were they did not want that to happen, right? The risk management came back and said it's too dangerous. They can't go into the field with you. So we had to pivot and figure out how this is going to work. How are we going to get into the field? Let's hire, put more people, move those PCNs from case carrying and have them be mentors so they can help train people in the field. So we knew there were problems for sure, which the audit does say, and we made modifications before this came out, right? Okay, this 2023, they show up at 24 to do the audit, thank you, and then we got this report in 2025. We're not sitting around waiting for this report, right? Like, we know where there are problems, and we are working on changing them. This is, we by no means are going to wait for a report to tell us what we already know, that we are missing the mark when it came to training. We knew that. So some of it is true. Somehow they got there, we didn't agree with. But at the end of the day, we knew our training needed to be adjusted.
So follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
So I asked a question in my first, I guess we'll call it a diatribe for lack of a better word. If this audit was repeated today, would all these recommendations still be there?
There's a lot of recommendations through the chair. There's a lot of recommendations. Let me, many of them would be, right? And I think there is a slide on here talking about solutions. Just passing 151 isn't going to change the child welfare system. OCS is one piece of child welfare, right? And I think there's a misnomer that if OCS isn't, that we are responsible for everything. Everything falls on OCS's shoulders. And if something isn't done right, it's OCS's fault. And that is not the truth. Now, we are not perfect. We make errors. We have problems. But we do a lot of things really well. And that is not highlighted. It's not shared. And it's not celebrated. And that's a problem because that contributes to our turnover, to our burnout, and to these sound bites that end up in the media that are attention-seeking and do not help in the long run. I mean, maybe they do. We get 151, right? I mean, there are things that happen that are, and I understand, I appreciate the advocacy, but I also would like to say there are things that we do well, and I don't think that that's often discussed or talked about.
Madam Chair, I just want to clarify with your permission, please. I by no means have contributed to any sound bites that I know of. Nor have I engaged in finger pointing. I think that was your phrase a little bit ago. And to your point, you said a little bit ago in that same sentence that you want to partner with us. And I hope you hear from me. I would like to partner with you as well. I have yet to hear what it is you need from me or from any of the members of this committee. We are appropriators and lawmakers. I think we made a law that we liked to think maybe could help you.
Yep.
And then I'm pretty sure we funded it. Your budget is 200 and some odd million in just OCS. Is it more money that you need? Is it more laws that you need? What do you need from me?
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, I love your question. If we can fast forward to the slide. There we go. What we need. We need to come back to the table and reimagine what can be done. And some of the things that we need to have a competitive compensation and benefits. We are not competitive in the market. We're not. I think that would help. I don't know how to go about that, right? I mean, I have enough positions. I don't have enough people in the positions. If my positions were full, I would be at the caseload averages, without a doubt. I don't need new positions. I need to think outside the box, right? And so part of that is compensation and benefits. I think, you know, our annual surveys, our exit surveys, they are all indicating competitive and compensation and benefits.
Madam Chair, if just on each of these points, if I can ask a question.
One more follow-up, make sure other members have the opportunity.
I sadly have to leave at 4:30, and it has nothing to do with this presentation. I just have a constituent meeting I have to get to, and I apologize for that. But this competitive compensation benefits, does the Office of Children's Services currently need additional money in your budget to do this, or is there something else that needs to happen? I feel like we're dancing around that question.
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, part of the problem is services have gotten very expensive. Our children in care have extreme needs, and so we have we would probably need more money in our budget initially, right? But we would then maybe be offsetting all the overtime if we had people there to do the job. So eventually it could probably even out, but I think that we would need additional funding if we were to have a higher salary or compensation.
Do you have that request in our budget books currently?
I do not.
Okay. Representative Gray and then Fields.
Thank you. Through the chair, what I heard was that 151, you know, wasn't going to fix the problems at OCS. But the reason why we passed it with such an overwhelming margin is because it was based on New Jersey. And New Jersey did vastly improve their child welfare system because they actually did hire lots more caseworkers, and they did reduce those caseloads, and they did reduce they weren't losing people. The turnover stopped. Like, they just vastly improved the system, and so we tried to do it like New Jersey. And I just wanted to say, if there was anything about anything that I've said at all in the last 6 months that seemed like finger pointing, what I've tried to do at every step of the way is say that we need to pay caseworkers more so that caseworkers will do the job, so that we have more caseworkers so we can lower the caseloads. And if that's finger pointing, I just don't know what else to do. I think I'm thankful for the work that you guys are doing, and I don't think that we're paying you enough. And we need to pay you more so that we can have more of you so that we can do this job better. And I guess I'll keep saying it, but it just seems like we're caught in this weird situation. If we're going to say that what we did in 2018 wasn't going to fix it, we never did that law. Like, we just never executed it.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, I believe that there are good components of HB 151. The intention was magnificent. It was fantastic. The support it had was fantastic. I will say, you know, New Jersey is so much different than Alaska, right? I mean, they can pull from 8 universities that are within, you know, like a 50-mile radius, right? That's not what we have in Alaska, right? We don't have numerous college-educated people that want to come work for Office of Children's Services. So that is, I mean, there are some differences. And I will add, and I think New Jersey is has done great things, they also do not pass the federal standards, right? They also are failing child welfare. Right. And there could be all sorts of reasons for that. So I just want to point that out. They did start off going really well. They are different than us, though. And I think that what solutions that we have to be unique for Alaska. And I've always appreciated your partnership. You've been to our office and have been problem solving. By no means do I think that you're finger pointing or anything like that. I'm just frustrated because a lot of times our staff do not get acknowledged and we don't talk about the great things that they're doing. The good things don't end up in the press, right? And it is, I have managers coming to my office and saying again in the press, like there's a lot of media and it's just one more thing to add to the trauma that staff are feeling. And I don't want to lose people because of media all the time, right? So I apologize if that came off too strong. So we bypassed a few other things. We'll just keep going from here.
Well, I wanted to ask a question on this slide, actually, Madam Chair.
Oh, sure. Representative Fields?
It's more a suggestion. So through the chair, the department has encumbered $10 million to pay fines. I would use that money to raise wages. And through the chair, I was curious if you've met with the head of ASEA, the employee union, to talk about implementing pay raises through LOAs. And if you haven't done that, I would recommend doing that because when you have a bunch of vacant positions and below market rate pay, the obvious thing to do is raise the pay. You'll have fewer vacancies. You won't actually spend more money. You will simply have more filled positions, each at a higher pay rate. And I guess I would ask, have you met with the head of ASEA? And if not, I would commend that to you and use some of that $10 million to fill the vacancies, and then maybe we won't have as much exposure to fines. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, I have not met with ASEA. I will say, however, there are rules on what I can and cannot do. Right, I have bosses who also put limits on what I can and can't do. Right, I have to get approval through all sorts of people above me to propose a letter of agreement or to do things. You know, we did do the state salary study last year, and it's not really showing that job class is underpaid. So that's problematic, right? So we are brainstorming on what else we can do to increase compensation. As far as the $10 million, my understanding is it's over with DOH, and I'm not sure how that works. I think it might at this point have been back to the coffers. But that is not in my budget or anywhere near OCS at this point.
Okay. Can I just note, Chair Mina, when the state wanted to hire airport dispatchers, state raised their pay 25 to 30% and filled all the positions. Where there's a will, there's a way.
To the chair, I would love to know more about that. So we'll be looking that up.
Great.
So some other things on this slide. The top part is kind of like things with that could really help OCS. Tuition assistance, loan forgiveness. You can come into OCS as a master's, a bachelor's, or no education. You're getting paid the same range as a starting caseworker, unless you have case experience. And also highlighting the good work that does happen at OCS and changing the narrative, I think, is important. And then things that are more upstream but that would be super impactful is really to improve the spectrum of services across the state of Alaska. So I'm talking prevention, intervention, like the whole spectrum of early engagement, prevention, tertiary. We are a small piece of this giant spectrum of services, child welfare services, social services in Alaska, and we are seeing a deficit in families going into homes and helping children and families. We are also seeing a deficit in affordable child care and early childhood intervention. These things really do help families from entering the doors of OCS, which is what we want, is people to help families before they get to our doorstep. We know that our lived experience, whether it's our parents or our youth, they're asking for peer navigation. People need peer navigation to understand how to access social services. Typically, families are in crisis, and it's very hard to navigate these systems when you're in crisis. a broad spectrum of community-based services, especially in rural Alaska. We have to be very we just have to think differently when it comes to rural Alaska than we do in urban Alaska. And I think that asking our communities in rural Alaska what this looks like would be important. And the last one is just strengthen the continuum of care. We are optimistic and super hopeful about the Rural Health Transformation Program. We think that's going to bring a lot of opportunity for the state to really look at getting us off on a better foot than where we currently are. So we're excited about those opportunities, and we look forward to seeing what's going to happen with those. Next slide. I just want to leave off with some of the good stuff that we are doing. I wanted to say again that we really try to live by being transparent. We are innovative. I'm hoping you can see that through the slides and the number of things that we have tried to stem the tides of our turnover and our vacancies and case assignments. We are dedicated in the work that we do here in Alaska. We're dedicated to our families and our children and our youth. We are committed to working with the voices of lived experience. This last year, 2 years ago now, we've stood up a parent advisory committee, and it is powerful hearing their stories, hearing the parents. Some of the parents have been reunified. Some of them have had their rights terminated, and they are coming forward saying, we want to help. So I do feel like we've got a lot of momentum through numerous partnerships and communities to really try to transform child welfare. I would love to be sitting up here and saying that 151 changed everything. I think it changed some things, right? But I think most of the things that it changed were technical. We changed policy, we changed training, but it's not changing the intent, which was changing outcomes for children, families, and OCS. So we're not there yet. I would like to say, but I don't think that's because we have lacked trying. I don't think it's because we haven't tried something. We continue to try, and we just are not getting those outcomes. I wanted to end with this last slide, and something I would love to see plastered somewhere. So we're one of the highest in the country with reunification of children in our state. That's powerful. Representative Ruffridge said 3 years for permanency. It's actually 24 months. But that is above the national average. The national average is around 20 months. We're around 24, 25 months to make permanency. It looks different if it's reunification compared to adoption, but the average is 24 months. It takes us longer to achieve permanency here in Alaska. But if that permanency takes 4 more months and we're getting higher numbers of reunification, maybe that's good, right? I will also add, when you're looking at reunification, what you want to also double check is they're not reentering, right? Like you didn't reunify today and take the kids back out 2 months from now. They're not. The children are staying home when they're being reunified, which is great. Again, one of the best in the country as far as reunification goes. So super impressed with where we're at. And this is broken by Alaska Native and American Indian versus non-Alaska Native American Indian. So I'll end with that and ask if there are any further questions.
Thank you. And I know we skipped over a few slides. I don't know if either the presenters or the committee members were interested in those other slides. I'm hearing nothing. All right. Representative Prox?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, I might be the only member on this committee who was here, was it 5 or 6 years ago, when you gave a report on turnover and everything else, and you almost broke down. We're on the TV screen, and the rest of us in here almost broke down. And you've been in my office a couple of different times with, what did you call those, community-based groups, saying, boy, we'd sure like to have them show up there than with your office. And today, you are more positive than you were 4 or 5 years ago, whenever that was. So that's good. I appreciate that. You said, well, the first thing that you said is really what I agree with, and how do we fix it? But you said, no law can fix. It was kind of almost your opening statement. Any suggestions? Well, no, let me offer one first. I think what I need to do as a member of this committee is spend about 6 weeks at OCS to really understand how it works or doesn't work or what the hell's going on. And that has been difficult to do. And then I've tried to emphasize the process in the Executive Budget Act that I've been harping on. And I think that's a really good process to follow. We can't tell you what to do. We have to figure out what you think you need to do and just say, well, all right, set a goal. Let's see if it works. But anyway, so with that, what do you suggest? No law can fix. I agree. But
through the chair, Representative Prox, first off, I wish it was a law that could just fix it, because what I don't like to say is I'm not following the law. I want to follow the law. We all do. I think part of the problem is our workforce, right? Workforce looks different in Alaska than it has years ago. And so how do we pull the right people into the job and pay them to do the work that's mm-hmm. needed? Saying that, we also need providers. I need foster parents. I need these community providers to help services. I need a parent to get mental health services or substance abuse services. And so we are a piece of this puzzle, but it can't just be on us mm-hmm. to figure out how mm-hmm. to implement and do all these things. And so I don't know that I have, like, if we just did this, I feel often like this is a recipe, right? It's a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Well, it didn't come out quite right, so let's tweak the recipe again. That kind of feels like what we are trying to do, and then you're evaluating, is this really what we wanted? Right. And so I feel like we're still trying to evaluate how to make this right, how to make the system fit for our children and families and youth. I think a lot of this needs collective input. It needs to be collectively dialed in and presented mm-hmm. in a way that change makers such as you all can hear and do. Mm-hmm. You know, I definitely have the position of what my staff and what we are seeing at OCS. But again, we're just a piece of the child welfare system. But I would say the biggest thing for OCS is our workforce. If I didn't have a 32% turnover rate, we probably could be doing things a little bit better. But with that said, we also are seeing higher numbers of reunification. I'm seeing less children in care than we've seen in years, and they're safely staying mm-hmm. home. So we are making some incremental progress, even with high turnover, 32%. And if we didn't have HB 151, that would look even more bleak right now than it would have before. So there is a lot to say that this bill has contributed to a lot of great things. It just is not going to fix what ails the child welfare system, unfortunately.
Follow up? Yes. You mentioned that OCS is broke. You should be in the legislature for a while if you want to see a process that's broke. But on a serious note, I wouldn't mind at all just spending time. It's across town in Fairbanks. I don't know if that's good enough, but I wouldn't mind at all being invited to be there on the ground, spend all day there, at least all day there, if not 6 weeks.
Through the chair, Representative Prox, we would love to have you. We have taken out legislators in the past. We've taken out aides. Mm-hmm. We really think it's an important endeavor to see what it is that we're doing. And you have full access to whatever staff you're out with for the day to really hear unscripted what their thoughts and opinions are, right? Mm-hmm. So we highly recommend, and we invite people to come and partake in really talking to our staff and learning more about what it is they're doing on a daily basis.
Right.
So please reach out to me, and I would be happy to connect you with our Fairbanks manager.
Acting Perfect. Director Dompling, did you have something to add?
Yes, for the record, Tracy Dompling, acting commissioner for the department. That's
my
apologies. Totally fine. I've bounced around in different jobs here in the last 3 years. So it's totally good. I did want to note, you know, I think that Director Guay has really hit on the fact that there's no silver bullet. What I have appreciated since being in this role is that OCS has made efforts internally to come up with ideas, make changes to training, the mentoring program. What's important, I think, is that we continue to review the effectiveness of those ideas. Some are going to work and some aren't. Mm-hmm. I am a leader who is never ashamed to say, you know what, that didn't work. What I'm ashamed to say is when we keep doing the same thing over and over and over again and expect a different outcome. So I have seen, and it's only been a short while, coming in as deputy commissioner, but I have seen that work. I have seen us even recently two, 3 weeks ago, reviewing some of the efforts that have been underway and saying, okay, some of these pieces aren't moving the needle where we want it to go. We need to go back to the drawing board and we need to figure something else out. So I just wanted to add that piece in there. I feel like, you know, they have been making efforts, they will continue to make efforts, and we will continue to evaluate the success of those outcomes.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I just disagree. I think this talking about how there were a couple of things that worked in House Bill 151, but overall it didn't, the heart of House Bill 51 is caseload caps of 13 per caseworker. We have never done that. So when I hear of saying, like, well, it just didn't work, we didn't follow the law. The law is an average of 13 cases per caseworker after their first year or whatever. And so I think you say, like, oh, well, we tried lots of different things and we're not going to keep beating our head against the wall. We need to do something massively different to actually follow the law as it was passed in 2018, which we've never done. And I really do think that if caseworkers only had 13 cases, they could focus on the children, what Representative Ruffridge was talking about. They would know their cases. They would know those kids. They'd be able to invest their time in that. They would be able to really do what's best for those cases. I mean, there's another representative in the audience today who's had experience with OCSS, and we all had experience, those of us who've been foster parents, of not getting a call for months. I'm not blaming the OCS worker who has too many cases. That's why I didn't get a call for months. What I'm saying is they need less cases so that they can do their job better. The heart of 151 is the caseload cap. That is the heart of that bill that was never implemented. So I would love it if we could experiment, just try it out for a year. Let's try implementing the law that we passed in 2018 and see if it makes a difference in turnover, see if it makes a difference in our outcomes, because we've never done it.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, how would you suggest that we stick to the caseload caps if we don't have staff? Should I stop screening reports or elect which families to stop serving? How do we do it?
Follow up. Thank you.
We
need to massively increase your budget so that we can pay your workers properly so that we can fill all those vacancies. I mean, that is the solution. The solution is that we have to fill those vacancies, and there is no alternative way to money. I think that that's the thing, is like we tried reducing the requirements for what it takes to do that job. That did not work. We've tried the recruitment incentive, like giving them a one-time cash thing. That $26 an hour is not cutting it. And, you know, I'm not the first person to do this. There are representatives who came years before me who said it is like a public safety officer. You know, you are going into a dangerous environment. You don't know what's behind that door, and it could be very dangerous. And, you know, straight up, we pay our police officers and our troopers more than we pay OCS workers. But they're putting themselves at risk, and the emotional toll is probably greater most of the time. They deserve to be paid for what we're asking them to do. And when we pay them appropriately, we will fill those vacancies and we can drop those caps and we can achieve what was the intent of the original bill.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Schwanke.
Thank you, through the chair. I see a similar response across state employment agencies with people being burnt out. 30-year retirement is a long time. I know OCS caseworkers have an unbelievably stressful job, and I just, in not being as familiar with with the bill that passed, I will go back and I will do some research and try to better understand that and where Rep. Gray is coming from on this. And I feel like there's some disjunct issues happening here, though. And when I see the overtime increasing drastically, that to me says we are pushing our caseworkers to quit. At some point, there's no level of money that is going to keep a caseworker from just being overwhelmed and walking away from the job. So I look forward to future conversations. I have some ideas that I've thought about for other departments and agencies, and when we do see burnout and high staff turnover, and there might be some creative ways here that we can really try to tackle that individual reason behind some of these individuals leaving OCS. So I just want to say I thank you for your 26 years. There's a level of dedication in an incredibly difficult field.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I appreciate your comments, too. Thank you.
I have a question, actually, and I have a question for the legislative auditor, for Ms. Curtis. I wanted to get more details for the record and for the public, just on the audit itself, the time span it was done, who at OCS was engaged, and then about PCG, the contractor.
This is Chris Curtis. I'm your state legislative auditor. So the background information provides some perspective. This bill, HB 151, had multiple different effective dates. And so it spanned from 2018 to 2020, I believe. So when it was passed, there was some concern about funding the positions. And so there was a requirement placed in the bill that the OCS cooperate with an audit. And so we planned the audit in three separate parts because of the different effective dates. So the first one, I think, was released in 2018 or 2019, looking at those first provisions that were effective. Then we were going to do the second one, but COVID hit. And there was no reason to look at an agency implementation of this bill when they are unable to do their typical procedures. So we put it off. So we did part two, came out 2020. Late 2022, and we immediately went into part four. So the there is some confusion about the periods that's covered. So we did look at, I think that's, and the audit talks about it, it's through December of 2023 when we looked at training. The consultant was in there in the fall of 2023. So if there's anything, I know they've talked about in their response to the audit, the talent acquisition team, which I didn't hear much. There are some other things they're doing with employment and recruitment that has happened since the time of our audit. So I'm sure that creates some confusion. But yeah, that's the period is pretty much through 2023 and then working. That was the consultants and then the auditors doing their work in our auditors doing their work in 2024.
Thank you. And just to follow up, I know PCG, the state uses them pretty often in different departments, but they do have a pretty good familiarity of a lot of the state systems. I don't know if that's an appropriate question for you.
Well, it's a question about if you're asking about their qualifications. We in the RFP, request for, it was a competitive procurement, and so they did score the highest, and they did have a cross-section of experience. And I don't know if it's included in their bios in the report in the appendix, but their actual full report is in the appendix and includes the qualifications of those that conducted the work.
Thank you. And maybe connected to the audit for Director Gway. So we do have seven recommendations in the audit, and it has been some time. So I could see a bit of confusion from the audit that had been done a few years ago and the progress that's been done now. And so out of those seven new recommendations, and I don't have to go through all of them right now, do you want to highlight what the department, the division has been doing in response to the audit?
Yes, thank you, Chair Mina. I'd love to. So recommendation one, I'll just quickly go through each of them. It was to ensure that procedures were in place for our annual staffing report being accurate. I mentioned that we've had some turnover in our administrative manager, 7-month vacancy, couldn't hire anybody. She was in charge of that. When she left, we kind of had, we dropped the ball, right? So we now have this streamlined and in smart sheets, so it cannot be, if the next person departs, we're still dialed in on that. So that was on us. We made some data errors there. Number two, OCS director should implement procedures to ensure annual recruitment retention report is accurate and prepared in compliance with the state law. Again, we had data challenges. It's hard sometimes to calculate who's got primary assignments, who's got secondary assignments, how many PCNs we have, especially when we do a lot of, like, here we are now, and when the auditors come in, they're saying, here's 2024, right? So sometimes we have to figure out where that position went in 24 and why it moved. And so there was some discrepancies in there, but I think that we created a process so that will no longer happen. Number three, OCS director should consider implementing more comprehensive training program grounded in practical applications. We started this shift back in 23. We were already doing some in-person. We're doing a week in-person. We were also doing the forensic interviewing, which was in-person, and we have the mentors that were going into the field. Now, during COVID, there was more Zooming rather than in the field, but they have, in the end of 23, they moved back to being in-person. And in 24. And we are in the process of re-evaluating training yet again and enhancing it right now. Recommendation four, OCS director should continue to implement hiring best practices. As Ms. Curtis mentioned, we have our talent acquisition team. We are a pilot through Department of Administration to see if we could streamline some of the hiring to get people on board faster. This is a newer program. I think it's been in place for 2 years. It started off kind of strong. Then we hit a bump where they had all vacancies, and then the hiring came back to us. It's back to the department now that's helping streamline this. We're at the point of evaluating to figure out next steps if this is beneficial or not. So we are trying to streamline. I will mention that hiring, there's a lot of things I believe in, like they're in the administrative code. This is not my expertise. That make it very difficult for us to make hiring happen quickly. For example, if I interview 30 people for two spots, I got to dispo out with narratives why I didn't pick the 28. Not that that's, but it's very complex. The workplace Alaska, you know, isn't always conducive for rural Alaska. And so there's things I think that we could be done differently. That's DOA. That's not OCS. More intentional recruiting. We've been at so many recruitment events these days. We were at the City of Anchorage's recruitment event. We were at South Central Foundation's recruitment event. So we've been attending quite a few recruitment events, trying to solicit folks to apply for jobs with us. One of the recommendations, expand the use of creative models to fill fill offices in rural Alaska. We have letters of agreement already in place with many rural offices in Alaska where they work a week on, week off. And so we haven't quite figured out what else to do that's creative to meet those needs. But we're open to ideas and suggestions. We do think housing would be a game changer for some of our rural locations because it is expensive to live in rural Alaska. The accurate nature described in the job. We created all new, brand new realistic job profile videos. Our staff advisory board did those. They're all posted on our website. So this one was completed back in 2024, end of 2024. Recommendation five, OCS director should consider enhancing data to align with best practices, making recruitment and retention efforts more meaningful. This one's a little bit about our TA team, trying to make sure that we're getting the right folks in the door. And we are doing the recruitment events. We are the first division that's doing this new candidate-centric streamline process. Time will tell if it's going to be morphed out to other divisions or states, entities.
Recommendation 6, OCS director should include a forward-looking plan addressing recruitment retention challenges over the next 5 years in an annual recruitment and retention report. We have a very robust recruitment and retention plan, and we have a 5 years forward-looking. I will say there was some discrepancy of what we believe HB 151 said compared to what the auditor said, but we do have a five-year forward-looking plan. The last one is the $10 million, which we've talked about. And that's the 7 recommendations.
Thank you. I really appreciate your time, Director Gray, and also to Chris Curtis, our legislative auditor, and for everybody at the division and the department. I think it's pretty clear from the committee hearing and from my colleagues on the committee, we want to help. We really, really want to do whatever we can to help OCS make sure that it's not just about caseload caps. At the end of the day, it's about helping kids and children in this state. And so the staffing needs, salaries, benefits, we want to help. We're eager to help. I think this is such a strong bipartisan issue in the legislature, and we're ready to continue this work in the subcommittee process and in upcoming hearings. So thank you so much for being here today to all of you.
Thank you all. I appreciate you.
Lastly today, we will hear a brief introduction of Senate Bill 83 by Senator Klayman on telehealth services. If Senator Klayman and staff Serena Hackenmiller could please come to the presenter's table, put yourself on the record and introduce your bill. And my goal is to end by 5:15, so we'll have a speedy introduction today.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the House Health and Social Services Committee. For the record, I'm Matt Klayman, Senate District H in West Anchorage. Senate Bill 83 is brought forward by healthcare providers in my district who provide both in-person and telehealth services to Alaskans across the state. Senate Bill 83 will ensure pay parity for telehealth, requiring healthcare insurers to reimburse at the same rate for telehealth services as in-person care. Telehealth reduces barriers to care and allows patients to receive timely and convenient care from the comfort of their own homes. In Alaska, barriers to care affect individuals in rural areas, those with disabilities, and those with limited transportation options. Telehealth is especially important for chronic disease management, mental health services, and preventive care. The COVID-19 pandemic highlighted the critical need for telehealth access, prompting the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, to temporarily implement telehealth parity. While this federal mandate has expired, some telehealth provisions remain in place. What was once a temporary need is now standard practice, and many states have made efforts to solidify permanent access to these services. At least 28 states have enacted similar legislation to Senate Bill 83 to ensure fair reimbursement for telehealth services. Alaska's Medicaid program already has telehealth pay parity. This legislation builds upon that existing framework to require the same parity for private insurers. Passage of this legislation will expand access to care, improve and maintain quality of care, and incentivize continued telehealth utilization. And my staff, Serena Hackenmiller, will now present a sectional analysis of the bill.
Good afternoon, good evening, Chair Mina and members of the House Health and Social Services Committee. For the record, my name is Serena Hackenmiller, staff to Senator Matt Klayman. This is a sectional analysis of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee substitute version O. Section 1 adds a new paragraph, number 3, to reference the definition of healthcare provider in AS21.07. Section 2 is the meat of the bill, establishing a new subsection C under Alaska Statute 2142.422, requiring that healthcare insurers reimburse healthcare providers for telehealth services at the same rate as for in-person services. Sections 3 through 6 conform existing statutes to Section 2 of the bill. Section 3 adds a new paragraph, number 68, healthcare insurance plans, to the list of provisions which apply to home rule municipalities. Section 4 establishes a new section requiring a home rule or general law municipality offering a group health insurance plan to meet the requirements of Section 2 and provides the definition of health care insurance plan as given in AS 2152-500. Sections 5 and 6 amend the statutes to conform with Section 2, including the statutes for group insurance plan covering state employees and self-insured group health insurance plans covering active state employees. Sections 7 and 8 repeal sunset language in session law pertaining to Medicaid telehealth parity. And Section 9, this bill is from last year, has an effective date of January 1st, 2026. And that concludes the sectional analysis.
Thank you. We do have one invited testifier to hear from, Dr. Sarah Doherty. Thank you for being patient. Could you please put yourself on the record and give your testimony?
Good evening. Thank you, Senator Quayman, for the invitation to testify in favor of Senate Bill 83 and to Chair Mina and members of the Health and Social Services Committee for your time and consideration of my testimony. For the record, my name is Sarah Doherty. I'm a physician, and I am speaking on behalf of myself. My testimony today reflects my experience with providing in-person and telehealth services in Alaska and represents my own views and opinions. I do not speak on behalf of former or current employees, including Search and Central Peninsula Hospital. I'm a clinical rheumatologist and one of, I believe, currently only 9 board-certified rheumatologists in the state. A rheumatologist, for those of you not familiar, is a physician who's completed 4 years of med school, 3 years of internal medicine residency, and 2 years of rheumatology fellowship training. I diagnose and treat patients with autoimmune diseases, including rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, scleroderma, Sjogren's disease, psoriatic arthritis, and other systemic inflammatory disorders. These conditions are chronic multi-organ system diseases, often striking in the prime of patients' lives, and can lead to chronic pain, organ damage, disability, and death if not diagnosed and treated appropriately. It's likely that many of you know someone afflicted by autoimmune disease and have heard how difficult it can be to access rheumatology services in Alaska. I reside in Anchorage, but I travel throughout the state to provide care to Alaskans living in rural communities, where access to rheumatology and other specialty care is sparse. I've worked in Alaska since 2013 as a hospitalist and later as a rheumatologist, and I've traveled from Nome to Kodiak, Dillingham to Fairbanks, Costa Buta, Ketchikan, and beyond, and have experienced firsthand, like many of you, the challenges that travel across our state can pose. For those suffering from inflammatory arthritis and other disabling autoimmune diseases, many of whom are profoundly immunocompromised and at risk for severe infection, these challenges are greatly amplified. Not only is travel physically taxing, but it's expensive and time-consuming and requires time away from family and employment. It's these challenges that my patients have faced that have inspired me to deliver in-person and telemedicine services throughout Southeast Alaska and the Kenai Peninsula, where I'm calling in from today, and also to be here talking with you today for my support of Senate Bill 83, which would require most commercial insurance plans to cover telehealth services at the same rate as in-person services. While I prefer to see patients in person when I can, it's not always possible, especially in the case of bad weather or when a patient is experiencing an acute flare of disease. Telemedicine services allow me to extend my clinical reach to address disease flares, meaning acute symptoms of disease, often severe pain, stiffness, or swelling, before damage can occur in bones, joints, or other organs. And it also helps me to expedite care that would otherwise take months if in-person visits were required. In just the past 2 weeks, via telemedicine services to communities outside the city where I was performing in-person visits at the time, I diagnosed and treated a flare of inflammatory muscle disease, which prevented emergency airlift of the patient to a local hospital. I diagnosed acute pericarditis, a life-threatening complication of rheumatoid arthritis, and was there on the line via telemedicine to coordinate care with EMS when they arrived on site to care for the patient. I initiated treatment for another patient's arthritis flare, subsequently preventing an ER visit, and adjusted medications for a patient with lupus in order to hopefully prevent need for dialysis in the future. In each of these cases, the visit involved reviewing the patient's chart and recent study results, taking a detailed history, examining the patient with a clinical staff member on the other end of the call in some cases, ordering labs, coordinating care, educating the patient on their acute illness and treatment plan, as well as documentation of the visit. In some cases, coordinating the care of these patients required more work than if I'd actually been seeing the patient in person. And so to suggest that these efforts should be valued or compensated at a lower rate compared to an in-person visit seems short-sighted, considering that reducing the reimbursement for telehealth services may mean reducing or cutting telehealth services for many practices across the state. And when you consider the cost savings to the insurance companies that we had just in the past 2 weeks by avoiding medical transport, avoiding prolonged hospitalization and ER visit, and in the long run, hopefully dialysis, it's clear that telehealth services really do provide an outstanding return on investment. I am an employed physician. I do not have a direct financial incentive related to the passage of this bill. I am here today speaking with you solely for the purpose of advocating on behalf of my patients. My patients often have, like I mentioned, multi-organ disease, and so even if I am able to provide telemedicine services, if they have a different specialist or a primary care provider that's in private practice that can't afford to continue those telemedicine services due to reduced reimbursement, that's going to affect the care of my patients across the state. So passing Senate Bill 83 and requiring parity payments for telehealth services by commercial insurance plans would help to ensure that the healthcare providers in Alaska can afford to continue to offer high-quality, life-saving, and cost-saving telehealth services that my patients will have access to when they need it, where they need it, and no matter where they live. Thank you very much for your time and for your service to Alaska.
Thank you, Dr. Doherty. And thank you for your testimony. We are close to our closing time for the committee, but I would love to entertain one committee question if anybody has one question each. Rep. Cox.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can't see anything wrong with this, but I want to find out. So have you talked? I'm guessing the insurance companies would want to weigh in on this. Have we checked with them or?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, we have communicated with the insurance companies and they have no opposition to this legislation.
Good. Can't think of anyone else. Is there anyone else that I should call that might be opposed to this? Save me some time.
Through the chair, Ghostbusters.
Ghostbusters. Very good. Thank you.
Great suggestion. Representative Schwanke, and then Gray.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, Senator, for being here. I just have kind of one overarching thought on this initially from doing some research. It looks like about half of the states have parity requirements and half of them don't, and that goes for private insurance as well as Medicaid. And one of my biggest concerns here at Initial Blush is we worked for many years to increase the capacity of healthcare in rural Alaska, and the cost of offering telemedicine is generally considered to be lower, a lower cost modality. And if indeed we are incentivizing a lower cost modality offered from an urban area, would this not disincentivize actual in-person care in rural settings?
Through the chair, Representative Schwanke, I would actually, the best person, he's not here now, but if you go look at the testimony, we actually had an economist that has written extensively about increasing access to health care, Jim Rebitzer, who's written a book called Why Not Better and Cheaper. And in his testimony at the prior hearings, he gave a better explanation than I can to say that it actually will increase access to health care in all places, because the challenge with telehealth is that without parity, often telehealth is underpaid. And so you actually start losing health care because you're not creating those incentives. If you're interested, we can try to get Dr. Roberts here to testify at the next hearing and answer that question in more detail.
Sure. Quick follow-up?
Quick follow-up.
Okay. I will absolutely go and review the testimony. I'd appreciate that reference. And it's just something to consider, the fact that when you set up an in-person health facility in a rural area and then you create the disincentive to have that rural in-care facility by creating parity with a lower cost modality of something offered from an urban area, it does have a very significant effect on that in the future. And I am very concerned that something like this actually will help disincentivize point of care in rural areas when it's in person, when it's necessary. So thank you.
And in response to that, I would note that actually the example of what Dr. Doty testified to is an example of how having the facilities of care, the practical realities that somebody in a rural community such as where you represent, somebody that needs to see a rheumatologist, the likelihood the rheumatologist will get to your community is quite low, and there's no chance you get the rheumatologist actually having their regular practice there, and so access to that specialty is actually improved through telehealth, and their ability to deliver that through telehealth needs the clinic in your community as well. We have nurses and other professionals that are there can coordinate the care with the specialist.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair to the sponsor, I'm very excited about the bill. I just wanted to make sure that with the rural health transformation asking for the physician compact to be passed, that if we do indeed pass the physician compact, that we would have access to hundreds of rheumatologists across the country to be able to provide telehealth appointments to our Alaskans all over the state. I mean, so that's part of it, is that this would allow telehealth providers outside of Alaska to be able to provide the care.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure. Absolutely.
Thank you.
I didn't think it was a question.
I'm just making sure that there's nothing in the bill that would prevent it, I guess.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, not that I'm aware of.
Thank you. And I did want to bring up a question just related to the Alaska Municipal League's letter just related to cost savings. But I will save that question for next time. But I would love maybe a follow-up or any additional documents related to telehealth cost savings. I know there's some concerns about employers or trusts and the rising cost of care. But thank you for your presentation today. Please note that Thursday, February 5th, there will be a Finance Subcommittee meeting at 3:20 p.m. The time is 5:18 p.m. in this hearing of the House Health. Before I do that, Representative Mears did join us at 3:20 p.m. I didn't forget. The time is 5:18 p.m. and the hearing of the House Health and Social Services Committee is now adjourned. I didn't.